Welcome. Good evening. A few days ago, we had a ceremony of receiving the Bodhisattva precepts, a refuge ceremony, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And Reverend Jean is offering a class on refuge in these three treasures. So I thought I'd bring up a related topic tonight called the Four Reliances. Almost could translate like refuges, but it's a different list. The pratisarana. So when we say the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, they're called sarana. Trisarana. This is the chatur for pratisarana. Sarana means like refuge or reliance. When we say Buddham saranam gacchami, to the Buddha, for refuge, I go. Saranam gacchami. So these four reliances that you may not have heard of doesn't come up so much, but I think it's a nice teaching. And it's in the Mahayana Sutras. And one place I recently came across it is the Parinirvana Sutra, the Mahayana Maha Parinirvana Sutra, which is a Buddha nature sutra. That's its main teaching. And in its pages is this teaching called the Four Reliances. So the first one is it's four pairs, basically, what to rely on and what to not rely on. So the first is to rely on the teaching, not the teacher. Or literally, rely on the Dharma, not the person who's teaching it. So people, including teachers, are ultimately unreliable. They're conditioned human beings, so they don't always get everything right. But the Dharma is reliable. The true Dharma is always gets it right. So I think of at San Francisco Zen Center, I heard the story that I think all of you have heard about this, what they sometimes call the apocalypse, when Richard Baker, the abbot, it came to the attention of the community that there was all kinds of trouble going on, that maybe people were trying to keep at bay, and then it kind of exploded and people had a lot of bad feelings and he had to leave. And I heard that at the time that he left, many, many people left San Francisco Zen Center. It was like people got discouraged by that teacher and therefore gave up the practice. Maybe they went to another place, but the way I heard the story is people just, if they had their Zen robes, they burned their robes, and they were like, this doesn't work, it's no good. This is the proof that it's no good. And if that is so, then I think that's where the reliance wasn't quite working here. They were relying on the person instead of the Dharma. Too much investment in the person. The teacher. So when the teacher probably actually conveyed a lot of great dharma in the time that he was there, and probably helped people, and people did develop practice and did develop confidence in the dharma. And then when the teacher kind of fell apart, the people forgot that they were actually relying on the dharma. The dharma got too mixed up with the person. So I think this is a great teaching, and that's like a practical example. When I heard that, I thought, how sad if people think that the practice doesn't work just because it doesn't work completely for one person. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So the teachings that keep getting passed along over centuries and millennia seem to be reliable because they keep working and they keep helping people. And people can be somewhat reliable, but the Dharma, in this case, they rely on the teaching, not the person. Also, you can't, judge a book by its cover, as they say. So there's many Zen stories about this kind of thing, like the sixth ancestor. You may know this Zen story of there was a Zen monastery in China where people were practicing Zen, and a bunch of monks practicing very diligently for a long time and trying to understand the deepest meaning of Zen. We're getting very close to the understanding, but the fifth Zen ancestor felt like, not quite. And then this random, illiterate lay worker came by, right? And he actually understood the Dharma even more deeply. And received the Dharma of the fifth ancestor, and people didn't like that because they like to rely on the reliable people who were like the longest term practitioners and the monks and those that they knew well and so on. Who was this new random guy who hadn't even been practicing Buddhism maybe at all before he got there? Kind of how the story is told. But he had some insight. He had some understanding. But because people didn't like it, they tried to chase him down and say, you're not the rightful heir of the fifth ancestor. The one who studied the longest is the rightful one. But in fact, the fifth ancestor felt like, no, actually, the new guy actually really gets it. And the Dharma is more important than how long he's been practicing and whether he's a monk or not. We've got to maintain the authenticity of the true Dharma, which is quite subtle in the Platform Sutra. It's played out exactly what the different understanding is, and these are like finer points, but it's important to get the finer points. So that's one example of how to rely on the Dharma, not the person. Also, Zhao Zhou, one of our great Chinese Zen ancestors, after practicing many, many decades in his later years, when his teacher finally died, he decided to go on pilgrimage and visit other teachers and develop his understanding further through basically meeting other teachers, meeting other practitioners. That was the way in the old days, is you get really stabilized with one teacher and in your understanding, and then you and your practice. And I think it was usually recommended that you do that for a while, and then you go out and you check it out, compare it to other teachings and teachers, ask them questions, and bring out the Dharma together across the land. So Xiaozhou set out to do that, and as he set out on his journey to meet others, he made this kind of vow to himself that if I come across a 7-year-old child who has some new understanding of Dharma that I haven't heard yet, I will respectfully bow to them and ask for the teaching. And if I meet someone who's practiced even longer than me, which there weren't many probably at that time because Xiaozhou had been practicing 60 years or something, but if I meet someone who's really steeped in the practice but is missing some piece, then I vow to teach them something. I always appreciated that story of Xiaozhou, very humbly willing to learn more and also compassionately willing to give more in terms of Dharma. And when he says, I'll receive Dharma from a 7-year-old child, if the Dharma is true, I will rely on the Dharma, not the person. They're a 7-year-old, how could they know anything? This is this first reliance, relying on the Dharma, not the person. So the second reliance is rely on the meaning, not the words. They each kind of build on each other. So now we're relying on the Dharma instead of the person, but rely on the true meaning of the Dharma, not just the words. Some of our Zen poems say this. What does we say? An emerging of difference in unity. Yeah, that's kind of along those lines. In the Sandokai, we say the meaning. What is it about the
words?
Well, there's that one too in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. This is like the source, the meaning. How does it go? It's like the meaning is not in the word. Don't rely on the words. The words, but rely on the source. And in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, we say, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. So, it's like, as we say, sometimes, read between the lines. So the lines are the written words, and in between them is the empty paper, the expanse of the background on which the words are written. So instead of relying on the words, we can rely on the space between the lines of words. Silence between the notes. Yeah, there's something there, actually. But we recognize the space between the lines and the silence between the notes by the notes and by the lines. And many Zen stories are about this point, that we're trying to grasp the meaning in the words, but it's actually... it's kind of behind the words. So unlike the sutras that are, explaining the words more in a more usual, rational kind of way, a lot of Zen stories, instead of explaining, it's words that just point directly. That's why they're so strange, because the meaning is not in the words. If we try to get the meaning in the words of a Zen koan, in a usual way of grasping meaning, it often doesn't work. So like an example is again Zhaozhou, after his pilgrimage, going around meeting all of his teachers, when he finally started teaching, a student asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Zhaozhou said, no. Which is not the usual teaching. The usual teaching is all sentient beings have Buddha nature. So of course, a dog has Buddha nature. So that's why the meaning is not in the words in this case. It's not literally that dog doesn't have Buddha nature. It's this person asking, does a dog have Buddha nature? They wanted to get an answer, and maybe they were kind of expecting yes, but they got no, or there isn't any. You could translate it as. So it's, in the Zen language, no doesn't mean like no compared to yes. That would be like, the meaning would be in the words, but this is the no that, that cuts through yes and no, and cuts through everything. All conceptual ideas, when they arise, we just say no. It's the practice of Zhaozhou. Not what I think. But as a koan, it's kind of strange. But it's one of our prominent koans. Of course, the dog has Buddha nature. Zhaozhou said no. So rely on the meaning, not on the words. It's also said that in the Lankavatara Sutra, that all the Buddha's teachings are like finger pointing at the moon, which is the same point. We rely on the moon, not the finger. The finger is the words that point to it, and we kind of have to look past the finger to the moon, to the meaning to which the finger points. So then the third reliance, the first again is rely on the Dharma, not on the person, the teaching, not on the teacher. Then if we're relying on the teaching or the Dharma, rely on the meaning, not on the words. Now, if we're relying on the meaning, then the third is rely on undivided knowing, or awareness itself, not on dualistic consciousness. In Sanskrit, rely on jnana, not on vijnana. So this is a Buddha nature sutra. So it's jnana is sometimes equated with Buddha nature. Sometimes it's translated as wisdom or knowing or awareness, because it's just pure knowing, not like conceptual knowing. It's like the knowing that is just aware right now. We rely on this undivided knowing that's not divided into subject and object. Vijnana, we call consciousness, is what seems to be divided into me knowing something, or a subject knowing an object, a mind knowing a phenomena. You could say, truly what seems to be me knowing something, when we examine closely, we find that it is actually just undivided knowing. We can't actually find a subject different than an object when we settle deeply into the present knowing awareness. We can't find this split. And this is something we've talked about many times here. When we listen to a sound and hear it as something coming from over there across the room, we we can settle into our direct experience more and more deeply, and then look for a sound other than the knowing of the sound, and find that we can't find something called a sound other than the knowing of the sound, and we can't find a sight other than the knowing of the sight, and we can't find a bodily sensation other than the knowing of that sensation. And we're really coming to confirm this in our own experience, which may not be that hard, but it does take clear, settled presence to just examine our experience very directly. Then we're kind of tapping into undivided knowing or wisdom. So we rely on this undivided awareness and not on dualistic consciousness. They're so similar. They seem so similar. We say, well, just knowing right now, it doesn't seem so divided. But in fact, we feel like there's stuff happening out there and I'm in here. And that's the illusion of dualistic consciousness. The other day I was making an offering at a Dharma Protector shrine outside here, invoking the Dharma Protectors to protect the true Dharma at Warm Jewel Temple. And as I was doing so, I heard this knocking. I thought it was maybe like the somebody banging on the door across the street. So I looked over that direction and I saw there's a car parked right in front of the Zen Center, and there was a bird. I can't remember if it was a jay or a crow or something, but standing on the car mirror, looking down at the mirror and attacking its face in the mirror for a while. So I thought, wow, these Dharma Protectors really like offer great Dharma right when you're about to forget it. I took that as rely on this undivided awareness, not on dualistic consciousness. Dualistic consciousness is operating like that all the time. We see something, see some reflection, we think it's not us, we think it's other. And if we don't like it, we attack it. We peck at it. But it's actually us. It's not other. Sometimes I feel like I'm not so different from that bird, pecking at my own reflection in this way, thinking of it as other. Maybe eventually, I don't know if the bird eventually learns that it's actually looking at itself, or if it just gets bored or tired. But it didn't do that forever. But maybe the next time it happened to see a bird in the mirror again, it thought it was an other. And so that's the third reliance. And the fourth reliance is rely on definitive teachings in this Parinirvana Sutra. It says definitive sutras, not interpretable sutras. But we could say definitive teachings, not interpretable teachings. So, as you might imagine, since it's the Parinirvana Sutra, it calls itself a definitive teaching. It would be pretty fun. Just don't rely on this sutra that you're reading. So it defines the definitive teachings as the Mahayana, the great vehicle, the Bodhisattva path, as opposed to the Shravakayana, the path of individual liberation. Don't rely on, it's a little bit narrow, the path of individual liberation. It doesn't take into account everyone's suffering. Rely on the Mahayana, and then the Buddha gets into, and also he's woven through these previous reliances in the sutra. He weaves in these prominent teachings from this Parinirvana Sutra. But they especially come out here in the definitive, the meaning of definitive teaching as opposed to interpretable. Kind of strangely, the Buddha says, in the Shravakayana, which is like what we would call the Pali canon, the foundational sutras of the Buddha, they're interpretable. And one of the interpretable teachings is one of the main teachings of the Pali canon, a great teaching, which says that all conditioned things, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent and unsatisfactory. They're unsatisfactory because they're impermanent. They can't be like lastingly satisfactory, reliably satisfactory if they're impermanent. Even if it's something nice, it's going to change. So therefore, it's not ultimately satisfying because it's impermanent. And all these conditioned phenomena are not myself. They're anatman. So the teaching is that we sometimes think that conditioned phenomena are ourself. Like a common one would be, this body is a conditioned phenomena. And, you know, if we start to think about it and examine it, we say, well, that can't really be my true nature, my true self, because it's impermanent. But therefore, these conditioned things like the body are not myself, and feelings are not really who I am, are not myself. And even consciousness, again, as vijnana, the divided consciousness, is not myself. And conceptualizations and perceptions are not myself, and habitual tendencies are not myself. So all conditioned things are not permanent, they're not satisfactory, they're not ultimately satisfying, they're not myself, and they're not pure. And which in Buddhist language usually means like free and liberating. They're bound. Impure means kind of like bound. It's one way of looking at it. So that's a great teaching for us, I say. But in this Parinirvana Sutra, the Buddha says it's interpretable. And I think it's interpretable because it doesn't mention the other side of the story. The other side of the story is unconditioned, the unconditioned. It's just talking about conditioned phenomena, which is basically everything. Conditioned phenomena is everything we ever experience through the body, the feelings, the perceptions, the habitual patterns and the dualistic consciousness. All the objects of the world also are conditioned, meaning they arise, at least they appear to arise, dependent on conditions, and they appear to cease dependent on conditions. Therefore, they're impermanent, they're unsatisfactory, they're not my true self. Because true self means like an Atman. True self is something that's unchanging and ever present. And they're not, these things are not pure. And that's an interpretable teaching, because the other side is the Tathagata, the Buddha, both the Buddha and Nirvana, or his freedom that the Buddha teaches, is the opposite of these four. In other words, it's not impermanent, it's permanent. There is a realm that is permanent. in this sutra, this supposedly definitive sutra, and this is the most important teaching, the Buddha says, in this Parinirvana Sutra, just before his passing away. His Parinirvana is like when he leaves the world after 80 years. Saying, this is my final teaching, is that there is a realm that is permanent, unchanging, that is satisfactory. That is, in fact, is, we could even say it's blissful and peaceful and free of dissatisfaction, and it's most radically, maybe it is self. We call it actually Atman. Again, it is a self, and it's pure of all, bondage and gout and stickiness. And that's the definitive teaching of this Parinirvana Sutra. Rely on the sutras that teach the permanent, the blissful, the self, and the pure. In Japanese we say, Jo Raku Ga Jo. It's in our invocation of Avalokiteshvara, we celebrate these four qualities of Nirvana. Jo Raku Ga Jo. And it's, I think, first taught, and taught over and over again in this 1,000-page Mahaparinirvana Sutra, these four qualities of Buddha and of the unconditioned truth. And we might say, that sounds kind of far-fetched. But if I think, then the Zen people, this sutra became very influential in the Zen tradition. And Zen people thought, it doesn't have to be so far-fetched. It can be just, we can actually call it ordinary mind. Our present awareness right now, upon close examination and deep investigation in Zazen, using the words as fingers to point us towards this, examining again and again, more and more deeply, this ever-present awareness, we can come to see a realm that's actually not changing. As our dualistic consciousness is arising and ceasing every moment, as it meets a new object, it's arising and ceasing. But the undivided knowing is not arising and ceasing. It's unborn and undying. This is the Buddha nature teachings that became so prominent in Zen. And this present knowing awareness that's not coming and going, and it takes some close examination to not confuse it with dualistic consciousness. Because that's what we're used to. And dualistic consciousness is impermanent. That comes and goes, and it's conditioned. It arises dependent on an object. But the awareness includes everything. It doesn't rely on objects. What we call objects are it itself. So we can come to see that it's unchanging, it's always okay, it's always content, it's not dissatisfied. Even when I, the person, am dissatisfied. And because we can call it permanent or unchanging and always satisfied by its very nature, then the Buddha in this sutra says, then we can actually call it a self. This tradition that is so keen on teaching Anatman, one of the most famous teachings of the Buddha is no self. So in the Mahayana, it's brought back in, but, it's clarifying this self, this Atman, is not a conditioned phenomena. It's not something that arises and ceases. It's not something that we can get a hold of in any possible way. It's ungraspable. And yet, it's ever-present. We can call it ordinary mind. Is the self, the radiant light of the self, as Changsha and Sister Changsha says. And it's pure of all mistakenness and duality and bondage, and it's a true reliance, it's a true refuge, this ordinary mind. So that's a teaching of four reliances from the Parinirvana Sutta, and a little bit of what the Buddha says about them. And I think it's nice to think of them in a way as refuges. They're the pratisarana. We can actually take refuge in the teachings. Actually, it's called the Dharma, is one of the three refuges, as opposed to the person or the teacher. We can take refuge in the meaning, not in the words, the true wordless meaning. We can take refuge in awareness itself, was another name for Buddha, or Buddha nature. And we can take refuge in definitive teachings or definitive sutras as Dharma.